their way home from a party. I even shared the avenue with a warden patrol that moved in the opposite direction, nodding my cloaked head at them while they bid us good evening. The leisurely pace did little to relax my mind. The whole ordeal seemed too easy. Granted, I had been lucky to wake up tonight, walk around the barrack wall, and overhear the plans for Iola Rothi tomorrow morning. But I was beginning to think that my generals really had not drawn a correlation between Schlara's death, the elven woman at my side, and my escape. Perhaps time had healed their imagined betrayal, and the previous group of hunters would actually be the last to attempt to capture me. We made it to the street that contained the inn, and I looped the large building, listening for any sound out of the ordinary from inside the building. I sensed nothing out of place, so we ducked through the doorway and into the warm common room. A fire had been lit in the back kitchen, and I smelled the robust scent of a beef roast simmering in a broth of onions, carrots, and parsnips. This was one of the more expensive inns of Schlara's Rest, but the food was delicious, the beds were clean, and the owner didn't ask many questions. Iola Rothi waited in the shadows as I walked around the kitchen counter and filled two bowls with the stew, placing them on the serving tray the owner's wife would use to deliver an ordered breakfast. Then I placed four loaves of yesterday's bread and a pitcher of water on the tray before motioning for her to follow me and moving up the stairs. Each time in our journey from the dungeon that I had been forced to let go of her had been physically painful. After the years we had spent apart, I wanted nothing more than to hold her, feel her skin and hair, and experience the incredible sensation that came when we touched. I never wanted to let her go again. I never would. Being so near her like this, and unable to touch her, took all of my concentration and discipline. I paused outside my room and used my ears and nose to sense anything unusual. Still nothing. I unlocked my door. The room was as I had left it. I closed the door, locked it, and then let out a sigh of relief. The first part of the escape was completed. The next part would be more difficult. Now we would have to wait 2 days before making it to the Sea Dog. Between now and then, the guards could put the city on lockdown and begin searching for us. They couldn't scent track us through the street, since there would be too many people walking around come the morning, but they would look at the inns first, and then the abandoned buildings. I needed a backup plan to get to the ship now that we had a few days of pressure. I set the tray down and motioned to her not to talk by putting my finger to my lips and shaking my head. If there were another O'Barney in the building, he or she could hear any of our words, even those most softly whispered. She nodded in understanding, and I drew her body to mine and buried my head in her hair. She was covered in dirt and dried blood from her stay in the dungeon, but I didn't care. It was still her, and I held her close to me and ran my hands over her body. She felt the same, though thinner, and the pleasure of feeling her again pulsed through me in waves. She pushed herself as close to me as she could, forcing us even closer than my tight hold. She inhaled deeply, eyes closed. We stayed like that for some time. Finally, the sharp angles of her bones reminded me she was probably starving, and I broke our embrace and pointed to the tray of food. She nodded and sat down in front of the food. I had a book of clean paper, a vial of ink, and quill I used to make notes of the escape. I had burned my notes every night after I committed the musings to memory. While Iola Rothi tore into the bread and stew, I wrote down my plan for our escape on the parchment. When she had finished eating both bowls, the bread, and water, I passed her the writings and motioned that I would bring her more. She nodded and smiled gratefully as I opened the door to leave. I did not want to leave her, but she needed to eat, and she was safer in my room than out in the inn where she could be seen. Even dirty and covered in a cloak, she was striking, obviously an elven and remarkably beautiful. Her bright hair was dulled with grime, but still longer and a more interesting color than any of the humans roaming the city. If seen, she would be remembered. I almost couldn't believe that she was finally here in front of me. I wanted to hear her voice more than anything, but I knew it would be a risk. I didn't want to take any risks at this point. The innkeeper bustled in the kitchen, and I did my best to make enough noise walking down the stairs so that I didn't startle him. "Good evening, lad. Couldn't sleep?" His name was Turp, and he had a thick head of graying hair and a neatly trimmed beard to match. He looked like he could have been a soldier in my army, but I saw no power about him when he moved, and his belly betrayed a love for his wife's baking. "No, sir. Put in a lot of work yesterday, and I found myself extremely hungry. Can I trouble you for some more of that meat, and perhaps some more bread?" I forced a smile to my lips. I wanted to be back in the room with Iola Rothy, but the expression on her face when she ate confirmed my fear that they may not have given her much sustenance in the last few weeks. "Sure thing, Wesson. Where did you say you were working?" His question was polite, and I realized his memory wasn't that great. I had introduced myself to him as Nias. Wesson was another tenant of the inn, but I was glad he did not remember me. "One of the smiths down the road. His apprentice is moving to journeyman status, which reminds me, I'll only need the room for 2 more days, and then I'll be staying with him. I think I am paid up till that time?" He nodded while he spooned me more of the stew, threw on a couple of rolls of bread, butter, a few uncracked eggs, and another pitcher of water. I had the name of a smithy down the road in case Twerp asked about the master's identity, but the innkeeper didn't seem particularly curious this night. "I'll be sad to see you go, lad. You are a nice boy, paid up front, and kept your room clean. It was a pleasure. I'll see you tomorrow for breakfast. I'll take it downstairs again." He nodded, and I hurried up the stairs back to the room. By the time I returned to Iola Rothy, she had finished reading my plan and sat with her eyes closed in the room's only chair. I handed her a roll of bread, and she nibbled on it while she read the words again. She seemed upset, but I did not understand why. I stroked the graceful curve of her neck while she was looking down at the page. I remembered that touching her had felt wonderful, but my memories had not done the experience justice. I was almost overwhelmed with the feeling of her skin beneath my fingers. Just this slight touch sent waves of pleasure through my body, and I wanted to make love to her more than I had wanted anything in my life. I feared making too much noise, or hurting her in her weakened state. I knew if I even kissed her now, I would not be able to restrain myself, so I resisted more than the gentlest touch. She reached up and held my hand to her cheek and closed her eyes, inhaling softly. Finally, she looked at me, gave me a ghost of a smile, and began to write on the blank pages of the book. "We cannot leave in 2 days," she wrote, and then turned the paper so I might see. I gave her a puzzled look, and she continued to write. "Malik has an artifact I need. It is being kept in one of his vaults in his estate." I moved my hand from her neck and took the quill from her and wrote, "The ovule?" She looked surprised and nodded. Then she replied, "You know they power our radicals?" I nodded and went to take the quill, but she continued, "For elvens, for our kind. O'Barney don't need them if they are powerful enough." She handed me the feather, and I scribbled, "The elven elder at that temple explained it. He said you were with someone." She nodded, and I wrote, "Who?" She took back the book and looked at what I had written for a few seconds longer than it should have taken her to read it. Our eyes met, and hers were bright, glowing like quicksilver, even in the dim light filtering into the room from the street lamp below. Icy panic shot through my spine, and I had to hold on to the bedpost nearby to steady myself. I no longer knew what I wanted the truth to be. I did not know if I feared finding out we did indeed have a daughter, or that we did not. She frowned, and then wrote slowly, as if each word was painful. I wondered suddenly if they had injured her hand while torturing her. Finally, she showed me the words, and I understood why she had written with such difficulty. "Our daughter, if we do not get an ovule, she will die." Chapter 20. Kyair. My head hurt. It was the familiar headache that seemed to occur after one of my blackouts. I struggled to open my eyes, and when I finally separated the lids, the light from the midday sun almost blinded me. Then I realized that it wasn't just my skull that ached. My entire body felt as if Thayer had beaten me unconscious. "Fuck," I spat the word out. The scent of my blood filled my nostrils, and my mouth tasted of the coppery liquid mixed with mud. I looked around, and my movement scattered 20 crows that had been feasting on the pile of corpses 50 feet from me. I struggled to my feet and collapsed back onto my knees. My head spun like a tornado, and I felt as if I would vomit. I made myself relax and pulled the earth into me. Its warm presence forced the aches and nausea to flee like the crows. Where the fuck was I? Where was Iolarothi? We had a daughter. The elven elder was correct. Thousands of questions filled my mind, and I tried to remember if I had ever gotten any answers from Iolarothi. But my memory was failing me again, and I didn't even know if I had ever met our child. Did she look like me? The elder said she had my eyes. Did she have Iolarothi's hair? For a while I sat on my knees and thought about what had been, what could have been, and what I had probably never known. A crow landed on my shoulder and startled me from my memories. How long had I been sitting here? I looked around and noticed that the sun had set, and the sky was in the later stages of a dark purple dusk. More of the black birds had gathered on the bodies. Rocks and logs circled a fire pit with a lidded pot placed on the ashes. I breathed deeply and mixed the scent of death with the ashes of the fire and the algae from the pond nearby. I shivered and pulled more earth into me. The 6 bodies appeared to be a few days into decomposition. They were riddled with dozens of holes. A few had black, fletched arrows sticking out where the bolts struck bone, but most looked to have passed through the bodies. What were they doing here, and why did I wake up next to them? A brave crow landed next to me and pecked at the face of one of the corpses as I crouched down to study the tattoos on their skin. My hand lashed out and crushed the creature's neck and half the bones in its body. The other birds circling the sky cried out in fear and then flew away into the night air, leaving me with the sounds of crickets and frogs that lingered in the dark pond. I looked at the body the now dead crow had tried to feast upon, and recognized the man. "Iaren," I said his name aloud, as if I could somehow bring him back to life. It looked like a single arrow took the tall woodsman in the forehead and passed out the other side of his skull. His jaw was still frozen in a gasp of surprise, but his eyes were closed. I sat again on the log and covered my face with my hands. The other bodies had tattoos of bears on their skin and carried an abundance of muscle. Iaren was no warrior. What was he doing in their company? And who had killed them? Had I killed them? I leaned back on the log and scanned the campsite for a bow. I was a skilled archer, not as good as Alexia, but with the right weapon I could place an arrow into the eye of a deer or boar at 300 yards. A quick count of the holes and arrows revealed math that didn't add up to my skill level. There was no way I could have put over 70 arrows into the group of 6 people while they sat so close together. It was obvious that they were caught by surprise, and the attack came instantly, or someone would have run. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and tried to think of my last current memory. My mind kept dancing back to Io Larothi's rescue and the plight of our daughter. I remembered Naya's camp in Fisherman's Gorge and the walk and brief lunch I shared with Danor. Afterward, I spoke to Nadia, and she attempted to talk me out of leaving. Then my recollection stopped. I sighed and lay on the log next to the bodies. Closing my eyes for that brief period of time caused me to feel tired. My back bumped against something, and I realized I was wearing a backpack that I had not even felt because of its exceptionally comfortable leather straps. I shrugged the pack off of my shoulders and pulled open the brass buckle. Inside was a pile of soft sheepskin cloth wrapped around a globe. I pulled out the ovule and wasn't surprised when the sphere glowed. It looked like thousands of yellow spiderwebs were trapped inside, and the effort of their escape from the prison made each strand pulse as a firefly. Like a punch to the stomach, I suddenly remembered the last few weeks. I recalled leaving Nadia's camp as a prisoner of Islata, the time I spent at the elven camp outside the walls of Naya, the talks with Virnine, the meetings with the Empress and her generals, the fight with Yillamar, and the negotiations I made with Talaxthi for her daughter's identity. My eyes studied the bodies again, and I remembered what caused their deaths. I couldn't risk going back with these O'Barney to whatever ridiculous trial their council required. I needed to be on this world, working to rid it of Talaxthi and her brood. So the Empress agreed to send Fehalda and some of her assassins after Kanneth and me, as long as I agreed to tell her more of her daughter when I returned. Of course, my plan had been to look for an opportunity for Beltor and Jesme to escape Fehalda's escort back to Naya. Then we would meet up with Nadia's army and flee Naya. In less than a year, I could create a whole new army of my kind with Nadia's soldiers, and we would then be able to retake Naya and end the elven existence once and for all. End the elven existence. The words echoed in my head. Did I even want that anymore? I thought about what Nadia had spoken of in her camp. She dreamed of governing a great and prosperous nation, of spending days with her people and nights in discussion with her father and me. How closely her dreams might have matched Shlara's, with our people prospering after the war. From my last memories, it seemed like they had created cities and some form of government. She would have wanted that. Then I thought of Jesme. The beautiful blonde princess had spoken to me about staying in Meriem, building a ranch and farm in the small village, raising a family, growing old and more in love with each other as the days passed. Her dreams also closely matched Shlara's. My friend wanted a family with me, and would be a wonderful wife and mother. Did I really care about elvens anymore? I put the backpack on and searched the corpses as I debated. Perhaps the deeper question I should ask myself was if I ever cared in the first place, or if the goal of destroying the elvens was just driven by Io Larothi killing my brother and father. If they had not died, would I have joined in a resistance movement, or would I have happily lived my life out, taking care of horses for the elvens and making love to Io Larothi in the hayloft? I didn't know the answer. Or perhaps I was afraid of the truth. I knew that I loved Iola Rothy, as sick as it was. I felt something for her the moment I first saw her. If I had forgiven her for killing my brother and father, I should also be able to forgive the elven race for atrocities that had been committed lifetimes ago. But forgiveness did not mean they were entitled to come to this world, kill humans, and take their homes. There must be a place they could inhabit peacefully. I had to convince them to go there, or raise an army and complete the task I had set out to do many years ago. I did find a bow behind a traveling pack I recognized as Ieran's. The pull on the weapon was much too light, but it would work. His bag contained a few traveling provisions, such as spices, small game traps, and dried fruit. I took the food and a light blanket I found and placed them into the pack that had been on my back before searching the rest of the campsite. Caneth carried a mean-looking axe made of grayish metal with engravings of bears on the bare steel. It was a one-headed variety with a wide blade extending out of the haft about a foot. The opposing side of the head ended in a straight point that would easily pierce armor and destroy bone. The handle was 2.5 feet long and wrapped in thick black leather. Its length would allow me to wield the axe with one or two hands. It had a simple leather harness that let the weapon loosely hang over my back alongside the pack opposite of Ieran's quiver full of arrows. The other warriors carried broad-bladed swords and curved antler-handled daggers. I took two of the best balanced daggers and the shortest sword I could find. Then I tied the sheaths to Caneth's thick leather belt and wrapped the girdle around my thin waist. We had traveled northwest of the capital, and Nadia's army was heading from the south since they had been turned away from Brilla. I didn't know how long I slept here at the campsite, but I guessed I would probably be able to catch up to Fahalda and her assassins before they reached the castle with Beltor and Jesme. I filled up a few water skins at the pond while I tried to recall the exact roads we took to get here. Then I washed my mouth out with the algae-flavored water and spit out the taste of blood. My mouth felt a bit cleaner, but I couldn't shake the scent of my blood from my nose. I didn't feel injured, so I guessed that the scent would fade in a few minutes. Once finished, I stood up from the edge of the water and stared toward the southward road. I was somewhat familiar with the land of Naya, having looked over maps with Pog and running northward after Jesme. But when I chased Jesme's kidnappers, we had traveled northeast. I knew there was a main road that traveled north out of the capital. Caneth and his now dead friends had taken me on it for a few short miles and then turned east to be closer to the coast. I imagined that if I just headed south as quick as I could, I would catch up to Fahalda. Fahalda. I remembered her standing in front of me at the campsite. Was that last night? She was angry at me, but I didn't remember why. Her white skin had flared red, and she drew her sword. I had looked into her eyes. They were black pools that seemed to pull me into their depths. My head started to hurt as I tried to remember what she said to me. Her arm pulled back. The swing had been good. She used her hips and just the right amount of arm, but no real speed was behind the attack. I attempted to move, but though her attack was slow, I couldn't seem to find the energy to dodge. Had she knocked me unconscious? No, I would have overcome a concussion quickly and woken up in a few seconds. My kind healed so fast that even cutting off an arm or a leg wouldn't do more than hurt like hell. We could attach the old limb and it would start to work after a few seconds. If the limb was lost, a new one would grow back in less than half a day. We could only be killed by a severe brain injury or a beheading. If Fahalda had cut my head off, I wouldn't be standing here right now wondering what the fuck happened. I would be feeding the crows, just like Kanath, Iaron, and the rest of their clansmen. I took another deep breath and tried to ignore the scent of my blood. Then I began to jog past the pond, up the crest of the hill, to the main road. The dirt path was wide enough for two wagons and ran southeast toward the coast. I recalled sitting with Pog one dreary day in Castle Naya, poring over the maps in the library. If my memory was accurate, this was referred to as the Bay Crest Trail, and was the quickest way to transport goods from the major port cities on the north side of Naya west without running through the capital. My feet pounded into the dirt like a torrent of rain, and I soon ran faster than a galloping horse. The weight of the axe threw me off a bit, and I was experiencing a strong headwind that made my eyes water. The road seemed to stretch on for as far as I could see, across endless sloping hills of sagebrush and scattered oak trees. I closed my eyes and increased my running pace. The speed forced me to bend almost horizontal against the path so that the axe, quiver, and pack lay upon the middle of my back, and I cut through the air easier. I knew the direction I ran, and the sounds of my sandaled feet dancing across the dirt road bounced off of the ground, returning to my ears like a bat's screech. If someone makes eye contact with me, I can prevent them from moving for a few seconds. Fehalda's words pried into my brain, and I saw her pull back her sword arm. I opened my eyes again and focused on the road, banishing the image of her from my mind. She must have hit me really fucking hard in the head to knock my memories from my conscious mind. I debated killing her with the axe, burning her with magic, shooting her with arrows, or even just bashing her beautiful white face in with my fists until there was nothing left but a red puddle. Then I remembered Nyarothi. Iolarothi's sister once saved my life, and it was apparent that Fehalda shared a bloodline with the pale elven. They practically looked like the same person. Fehalda hadn't killed me, so I didn't need to kill her, unless there was no other way to free Jesme and Beltor. I was moving as fast as I comfortably could now, my heartbeat just below a full exertion, and my legs had gained that warm, comfortable sensation that slowly inched through my hips, stomach, and into my chest. The road blurred beneath me, but I could keep the pace up all day as long as the road ran wide, straight, and even. From my memories, it was rare that we ever got to run like this. Sure, running was a large part of our training, but we did our sprints in forests, canyons, and hidden valleys, far from elven eyes. It was too dangerous for us to run as I did now. In open terrain, it would lead to capture or attack. I laughed to myself and realized that the situation was still the same, if not riskier. I ran alone now, on a world with thousands of elvens that would love to kill me. Perhaps I should be more cautious. Then again, if I didn't get to Jesme before Fehalda returned her to Naya's capital, I would have to deal with all of those thousands of elvens instead of a few dozen. I gritted my teeth and pushed my run at a pace I could only keep for a few hours. "He won't die. This is impossible. What do we do?" Gorbani's voice repeated the question I had heard many months ago in the bowels of the caverns under Naya's dungeon. My stomach clenched, and I felt the familiar nausea follow. I couldn't remember when he said that to me. Was it before I killed Shlara? Who was he speaking of? I saw Fehalda arch her arm back, but it wasn't her. It was Malik. Half his wolf-shaped helm had been torn off, and tears made clear trails down his dusty face. Most of his armor was smashed, dented, and covered with blood. He pulled back his sword arm, and I could not move. Then he struck. It was the same feeling I had with Fehalda. I couldn't move, I couldn't dodge. I felt the blow coming, and then I'd seen thousands of my kin killed in battle. I helped clear their broken and soulless corpses from the fields of war. We could die. None of us were immortal. Yet here I was. From what these elvens and Caneth explained, it had been around 5,000 years since I last battled the elvens. I wasn't dead. Was it because I slept in the radical that time had no effect on me? You'll be angry for what we have done to you, but we had no choice. Did my old generals try to kill me and fail? Maybe they captured me and couldn't bring themselves to end my life, instead choosing to exile me through the radical to some world that they thought no one would ever visit. But then why had I slept for so long? How did Nadia and Pog awaken me? I had asked these questions before, but the only answers came through my strange flashbacks. Each one pulled me into my past, offering me insight at the same time that they created more questions. It was frustrating, but I had plenty to do in this time, and I had to keep my focus here. Something about Fehalda deeply disturbed me, and I could not puzzle out what it was. I had the same sensation as trying to remember a forgotten name. The answer was shallowly buried, but I had yet to find the right place to dig. The road had been moving up the sloped hill of a valley. These were wide, rutted-out switchbacks, surrounded by cactus and rosemary bushes. I recalled descending the climb with Caneth and his two guards many nights ago. I figured that we were probably 60 miles northeast of Naya now, since it had taken us a few days to reach the camp where Jesme and Beltor were being held. When I crested the small mountain, I glanced off into the distance. The night had descended into darkness, lit by one of the two moons and the sea of stars. Despite the darkness, my eyes saw the faint outline of distant campfires coming from the capital. The trail wound and dipped like a river through half a dozen other shallow valleys, but I was unable to see light from another campsite fire between me and the city. Either Fehalda's warriors did not make a campfire for the night, or they had pressed on to the elven army without stopping. Or they were already at the castle. The road forked, and I took the south route toward the castle. The path became less dirt and mud, and more gravel poured over hard-packed sand. I was thankful for the change, since it allowed me to run faster. I passed by more farms and estates with vineyards covering the hills behind the grand villas. When I followed Jesme's kidnappers, we took a different route north, more inland, and while I chased them through many farmlands, I had not seen such massive and elaborate-looking homes. It must be that the countryside, some 60 miles closer to the coast, was better for wine. I ran for another hour and a half before I slowed my sprint. I had not come across Fehalda's assassins, and I was within 10 miles of the capital. The roads were now cobblestone, and the homes were more frequent. It was possible that my quarry took a different route, but a quick inhale brought me the lingering scent of elvens, horses, and Jesme. Her scent was very faded, so I guessed I was 6 or more hours behind her. They had probably already reached the castle. I cursed my luck and pushed onward, slowing my run to a normal human pace so as to not cause too much attention to myself, or at least as much attention as someone jogging at midnight with an axe and a quiver of arrows tied to their back would draw. I crested one of the last sloping hills before the bold valley surrounding the capital. Naya. I had already been within the borders of the city for the last few miles, but it wasn't until a traveler got within sight of the castle that the enormity of the land became apparent. The Stone River ran like a small ink scratch east to west and fed into the coiled maze of the city. The walls were higher than 80 feet, half that distance thick, and would probably never fall to an army that didn't possess magic. Within the walls, homes, businesses, streets, and parks fought an endless struggle for dominance. Roads twisted and turned as if they were alive. If a structure met too much opposition on its sides, it rose up into the sky to mock those who had tried to crowd it. But neither the walls nor any tower in the city rose as high as the castle. It sat like a fat black spider in the center of the web-like streets. The fortress must have been over 200 feet tall, with smooth, sloped walls, towers that extended as legs, and hundreds of windows that gave the impression of glowing eyes against the night sky. It was beautiful and menacing at the same time. Looking at it again made me wonder if humans had actually built the palace. The stonework of the castle wasn't the same odd greenish metal material that graced the walls of the Radical, but the fortress seemed to be impossibly tall and alien when compared to the other crafted dwellings of the city. Even Brilla's brilliant blue capital had nothing that came close in grandeur to the Castle of Naya. I also doubted Elvens had built it. From what I understood from various conversations with Islata, Alatoricht, Virnine, and Talaxthi, Elvens had never been to this world. But they sure as hell were here now. The tents from the Elven army surrounded the outside of the wall like too many grains of rice on a dark wooden table, but there weren't as many fires as I thought should have been lit. The gate into the city was open, but glowed brightly under the mantle of enough wall braziers to melt the stone of the wall. Although I was about 3 miles away, I could still count 20 Elvens plus half a dozen human guards inspecting another group of 100 or so soldiers. The situation seemed odd, until I recognized one of the soldiers being inspected. Danor. Fuck! I cursed again, and did mathematics in my head. I had been a day or two off in my plan. Nadia was already here. She must have been notified of Brilla's political shift a few days after Islata had captured me and made her way north with the army. I needed to speak with Danor and find out exactly where Nadia was. If she hadn't met with the Empress, I would still have leverage. The conversation with Talaxthi in her pavilion had not gone quite as I expected. She wanted to see her daughter, but she asked no questions as to her health or well-being. I wouldn't have answered if she had, but her detachment made me think that she saw her half-human child as a tool instead of an offspring. Perhaps this was how all Elvens viewed their children. It was possible that if Nadia and the Empress met, they could work out their disagreements. Perhaps Talaxthi would throw her arms around the Duchess, overjoyed to be reunited with her long-lost daughter. Nadia would be able to negotiate a surrender or removal of the Elven forces. Or maybe because of their kinship, our two races really could coexist in peace. I suspected the Empress would be more interested in manipulating Nadia to her own ends. She wanted her army in Naya for some reason. Did her reason have something to do with the castle? The thought struck me suddenly, and for a few seconds I forgot about trying to speak with Danor. The story they had fed me was that Naya was the most prosperous of countries, with perfect vineyards, endless ranch land, and easy borders to defend. But I sensed that was bullshit. She needed the ruins beneath the castle. Danor looked to be arguing with one of the Elven guards. They stood too far away for me to hear, but I could tell that their troops were being denied entry into the city. There were tents on either side of the main road, and various elvens walking or riding between me and the gates, even at this late hour. I debated jogging the rest of the way down the road, but didn't know if it was worth the risk. The last time I entered the gates, the guards did little more than nod at me, but I had concealed my weapons in my travel bag, and a river of refugees coming and going from the city helped obscure me. Now that the Empress was here, it appeared that the elvens were being more vigilant about protecting their new city. I suspected that I would be stopped and questioned before I even made it to Danor. But if Nadia's troops were allowed to enter the gates, I could lose Danor in the streets and would never get any answers. I started to jog down the hill. Pog had told me that no one was allowed to build or own the property for a mile radius around the walls of the city. The boy said it was to make sure that an attacking army did not have easy access to timber, food, and archer cover. I wasn't thankful for the law now, since it meant that I jogged across the open road surrounded by elven tents and no cover. At least if I was called out, I would run through the encampment and cause some hilarious confusion before I would be killed. I passed a group of elvens sitting at their campsite playing a dice game next to the fire. They looked up from the game and eyed me suspiciously. I noticed their uniforms were blue with white threading, and guessed that meant they were part of Jaita's army. I kept jogging past them and hoped they stuck to their game. The tents grew more dense a mile from the gates, and I decided to slow down to a walk as I passed another group of elvens going northward on the road. There were two women and four men, all clothed in brown leather armor with red circles etched on silk cloth that hung from their shoulders. I moved to the edge of the road to let them pass. "Good evening," I said with a slight smile to a male that looked at me. "Get to a medic, human." He seemed disgusted, and I nodded in agreement before I turned my back to them and continued my walk. It was a strange response, but I did reek of blood, and the elven sense of smell was stronger than a human's. I passed a dozen more elvens that gave me little notice. In fact, the closer I got to the gate, the less suspicious the looks seemed to be. They probably thought that since I had passed other elven soldiers and not been stopped, I must have a purpose here that was approved by someone of authority. Each step drew me closer to the gate, and I almost doubted that I would make it the last 100 yards. Then I stood at the back of Danor's group of warriors and shouldered my way through them to where the knight captain argued with the elvens. "My orders were to enter the city and wait for the Duchess. I don't care what you say. You'll care what I say when we butcher you and your little soldiers and send your heads back to your army for consideration." The guard arguing with Danor was a male and dressed in Alatoric's gold uniform. I put my hand on Danor's shoulder and interrupted the man's reply. He turned his head around with a frown, but when he saw me, his face changed to shock. "Kyair," he smiled and grabbed my shoulders. Then his face grew worried. "By the spirits, friend, are you hurt?" His eyes went to my chest. "No, I'm fine. Where is Nadia? How long have you been here?" "She was escorted into the city shortly before sunset. Graykin and Runeer are with her. She asked me to bring a small attachment of troops into the castle walls if she did not return by midnight. Their general," he pointed back at the elvens, "gave us permission to enter." "I was not notified of that," the elven sneered. "You should leave now. I've grown tired of arguing with you." "Where is the rest of the army?" I pulled Danor's shoulder so that he turned to face me instead of the elven. "One of them could kill 3 of Danor's men easily, and he was dangerously close to escalating the situation. We are on the south fields. Let's go back. Nothing can be accomplished at the gate. What name did he call you, human? The guard asked me, and I realized that Danor used my name. Doesn't matter. Sorry for bothering you. We'll return for the Duchess another time. I gave Danor a look that communicated the seriousness of our situation, and he nodded. Back to the camp, he ordered the sergeant standing next to him, who promptly shouted out the orders. The warriors turned and slid south along the wall, rounding its curve but leaving plenty of space between us and the elven tents. I thought you'd be dead, my friend, he said once we could no longer see the gate guards. I'm hard to kill. You practically look dead. Please tell me that is someone else's blood on your tunic. He squinted in the torchlight and pointed a finger at my collarbone. I looked down and realized that the blood I had smelled was coming from the green shirt I wore. The collar, top of the sleeves, and half of the chest were stained dark red. It smells like mine, but I am fine. Do not worry. He nodded and gestured to their campsite. There were a few thousand tents, organized in a neat grid on the south side of the wall. Each tent flew a purple Naya flag, along with a small source of light nearby, either a campfire or a lantern. The humans needed much more light in their camp than the elvens did. When did Graykin find you? The army had marched up the coast. He sailed on a boat with the Queen, and they flagged us. How did they get separated from Beltor and Jesme? I'll tell you that tale, but first let me take you to my tent, get you a bath and a change of clothes. Yes, to the change of clothes, but take me to the command tent first. He hesitated and then nodded before he issued orders to have the men disperse through the camp. It's a shitstorm in there, he muttered after his soldiers had scattered into the tents. I didn't pay attention to the city. Has it gotten worse since we delved into the sewers? Sorry, I should have clarified. It is a shitstorm in the command tent. He gave me a crooked grin, accompanied by a sigh of frustration. That is why I am going there. I smiled back at him and could already hear the commotion inside the pavilion as we got within 300 yards of it. The voices inside were shouting so loud that the noise had attracted the attention of a few dozen soldiers. The Naya warriors listened hesitantly to the battle with disappointment painted on their faces. Like I've been saying for the last hour, that idea is completely ridiculous. We cannot negotiate a surrender with them. I recognized the voice of Merrick before I entered the tent. I smiled as I approached the two guards posted outside the front flap. They exchanged glances with Danor and pulled back the entrance for us. There were 5 men and a woman engaged in the screaming match. Merrick, who looked like an older version of the handsome blonde man Runeer, the ancient and semi-retired Wheaton, the lean and weathered Yebar, the soft but charming Corvan, and the sword master Juliar, who was always dressed extremely well and never seemed to be worried. The woman I spent an unfortunate few days of travel with and had almost killed out of annoyance, Jesme's mother, the Queen of Naya. I knew the 4 men ranked lower than Merrick on the command structure, but the exact specifications escaped me. I recalled that there were 3 other generals in Naya's army that might have been equal to Merrick. They were currently in the north, with the majority of the forces aiding Nuvanna, Lurma, and Timata in their defense against the Empress's army. But the elven army managed to either destroy them outright or had skirted around them and made it here through the icy mountain passes. I hoped that it was the latter. It sounded like the northern army was over 25,000 troops strong, and the thought of the elvens trampling over them en route to the capital made my jaw tighten. Those forces wouldn't make any difference now, but I didn't want any more of my humans killed. Our arrival halted the Queen's reply to Merrick as the first syllable left her mouth. The men quickly turned their heads and mirrored the confused look on her face. They stood over a large planning table with a 10-foot-long canvas map of Naya spread across it. I had seen the map before, and it was detailed enough to show the current layout of the city within the massive walls. Troop morale suffers when their leaders squabble like children. I said the words softly while moving through them and standing on the far side of the table. I took the quiver and bow off my shoulder, laying them on the carpeted floor next to me. I looked down at the drawing, and then looked up to Danor, who had sheepishly followed me into the tent and stood behind the other generals. An idea had been building in my mind during the walk around the walls, and the view of the map helped mature that thought into a plan. "Kyair," Merrick's voice was as soft as mine. "Did you escape from the Elvens? We believed you were prisoner. He is probably here on their behalf, just as my son thought. He has been their agent all along," the Queen sneered. The tall blonde woman was quite beautiful, until she opened her mouth and spewed out her vile thoughts. No amount of physical attractiveness could overcome the ugly of her personality. "Nadia saw Nanos kill his father, your husband, the king. Then he killed my friend Pog. When your daughter was kidnapped, I chased after the Elvens for 2 weeks and saved her from almost certain torture. Then I negotiated the release of you, your husband's brother, and Graykin from Elven capture because your son betrayed us again. He stabbed Nadia in the stomach, and if I had not been pressed for time while attempting to escape from the castle, I would have enjoyed painting the walls of your royal safe room with his blood." As I spoke the words, her face paled and then turned a bright shade of red. The woman stood about 10 feet away from me on the other end of the map, which was why her face looked so surprised when I jumped over the table, grabbed her by her pretty throat, and lifted her a few feet off the ground. "I don't want to hear you speak again," I hissed through my teeth and pushed my face up against hers. "And the only reason you aren't dead now by my hand is because it would upset Jesme." I squeezed a bit harder, and her already wide eyes grew impossibly large and frantic. Her nails dug into my left forearm, but she didn't have the strength to lift her body and relieve the pressure on her neck. I heard the rustle and rattle of the men behind me putting hands on their swords, but I doubted any of them would pull the blades out. "Now get the fuck out of this tent!" I pushed my arm out slightly and released the woman. The Queen fell out of my grasp and tumbled to the carpeted ground with a frantic gasp of air. Her hand went to her throat and the bruise that was starting to form there already. She looked up at me with malice, mixed with a larger portion of fear, and then crawled back against the floor toward the exit of the tent. Her eyes darted between the other men. Perhaps she expected them to come to her aid. But she had no friends here. "Have a guard take her to her tent. She is not to leave. If she attempts to contact her son or the Elvens, let me know, and I will break one of her hands," I said to Danor. The man nodded, and the Queen let out a muffled whine. I thought about telling her how fitting this was, that she probably understood fear close to the same way that her daughter did while under her supervision, but I wasn't going to rob that opportunity from Jesme. Danor pulled the Queen to her feet and walked her out of the command pavilion. By the time I moved back to the table, he had instructed a guard to take the woman to her tent and assign sentries so that she couldn't leave. I looked at the other men gathered behind the map and measured their mix of fear, outrage, and relief. This seemed to be a recurring problem with the royal system of leadership. Their rulers became entitled to their power despite results, and those who served came to depend upon that fucked-up form of slavery. "We've lost the battle for Nya," I said when Danor returned, "but the war is not over. We need to get space and buy time so that I can retrain your army." "Retrain the army?" Merrick asked. The man had never liked me, but this question didn't have the mocking tone he normally carried when he addressed me. "Yes," I nodded, and put the flat of my palms on the wood table. "I can kill these elvens. You've seen me do it, or heard of me doing it." I looked around the table at the men, and then made eye contact with Merrick. When Nadia and Pog awoke me, I didn't remember much of my past, but now I do. I was once the general of a great army whose only purpose was destroying the elven race. And we were successful. "Kyair," Merrick stopped me politely with a raised hand, "our country owes you tremendous gratitude, but claiming that you can fix this situation single-handedly is hard for us to believe. These creatures are too powerful. The only option is to surrender," Corvin said, while he shook his head. "No, we need to fight like the Duchess wants. We can whittle down their defenses and take back our kingdom." Juliar's voice was slightly louder than Corvan's. "And live like hunted animals for the rest of our lives?" Corvan yelled, and the tent exploded into another shouting match between the five men. "Do you have another copy of this map?" I asked without raising my voice. The men continued to argue, but it looked like Danor might have heard me. He just shrugged his shoulders when I glanced at him. I could understand why the man had not wanted to bring me here. I pulled the axe off of my back and shook loose the backpack. Then I pulled the leather cover off of the blade of the heavy axe and smiled when Danor gave me a worried look. The other men didn't notice me brandish the weapon, but I doubted that they would have stopped bickering even if they had. I put my right arm out on the table, over the sketch of Nya, and then slammed the blade of the axe down on my forearm. The massive weapon easily cut through the skin, muscle, and bone. Blood from my stump of a forearm sprayed over the desk, the map, and dripped onto the ground. Danor shouted, and the other men backed up with a surprised cry of absolute shock. "Let me explain how this is going to work moving forward," I said with a smile on my face. I was used to pain, but getting a bone cut in half was never pleasant. I reached across the table with my left hand and grabbed the wrist of my severed right arm. "I have powers beyond what you know, and I have magic more powerful than these elvens." I put my forearm back on the cut stump and felt the nerves, muscles, and bone begin to reattach. The feeling was more annoying than the cut that severed them. "These powers can be given to others, and I know the process." The men's eyes grew wide when my fingers wiggled. "But first, I need to get Jesme, Nadia, Graykin, and Beltor out of that castle so we can regroup." My hand closed into a fist and then opened again. The cut that the axe had made across my forearm stopped bleeding and scarred. "I have a plan, but I don't need you to help me with it." I looked at the men and saw the fear on their faces. "I'm not going to patronize you with the illusion of choice." I smiled, and they understood what I implied. I figured they would. These were smart men. They were just afraid. They needed a strong leader. "So does anyone wish to join the Queen in her tent?" They all shook their heads. "Good. Let's get started."
Chapter 21. Jesme. My balcony had perhaps the best view of the royal gardens. From my private river stone-paved veranda, I could see almost every single fruit tree and blooming flower. and the small brook that carefully meandered through the grounds. I couldn't guess precisely how high I was, but my view was not obstructed by any of the tall trees. The drop would surely kill me. I felt the cold stone of the balcony rail under my palms. They were sweaty with nervousness, and it made the smooth gray rock feel frigid. I leaned over again and looked straight down to the garden. The edge of the brook was directly below me. There was some grass, but it was mostly boulders, placed to make the view aesthetically pleasing. I closed my eyes and imagined how those short, weightless seconds would feel. Would I experience any pain when I touched the